This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the December 28th edition of Takes on the World, a public affairs program that comes your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. Every other fifth Wednesday, I want to open the phones to you, our listeners. As I have mentioned on a number of my past programs, there's been an ever-increasing drumbeat for an attack on Iran from the same major pro-Israel Washington think tanks and media pundits that brought us the Iraq War. With Iraq in the wake of 9/11, we were told that not only had Saddam committed genocide on his own people and that he was a major source of worldwide terrorism with links to Al-Qaeda, but that his weapons of mass destruction threatened the United States and our national interests, and for those reasons he needed to be taken out. There were not, as we now know, any weapons of mass destruction in Iraq other than the ones we used against the Iraqi people. And almost a decade later, we have a good idea of the cost of that decision. And despite the charade of withdrawal by the Obama administration, that war is far from over. Now unable to create a charge of genocide against Tehran, it having allegedly replaced Iraq as a major source of worldwide terrorism, not getting anyone but Israel's aficionados excited, and its crackdown on internal dissent being far from a casus belli, the warmongers tell us that Iran's very legal nuclear facilities must be destroyed before they are able to build a nuclear weapon which would make it a, quote, existential threat to Israel and therefore to American interests. It's one thing to just adore Israel, as the evangelical Christians do, wrote Time magazine's Joe Klein. It's another thing entirely to send American kids off to war yet again to fight for Israel's national security. That sentence, as could be expected, earned him a place in the Zionist run purgatory, along with the New York Times' Tom Friedman, who just days earlier had written, quote, "I sure hope that Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu understands that the standing ovation he got in Congress this year was not for his politics. That ovation was bought and paid for by the Israel lobby," end quote. Tom Friedman. Listeners to Takes on the World, of course, know that what both men wrote is what I've been telling you for years. That the truth has now reached the mainstream hopefully means we are making progress. Both Klein and Friedman were quickly forced to backpedal. Klein's excuse was that he didn't mean what his sentence clearly meant, that the Iraq War had been fought for Israel. He apologized for putting a comma in the wrong place, while Friedman suggested that instead of accusing the Israel lobby of buying Congress's 29 standing ovations for the Israeli prime minister, he should have said, quote, "engineered it." Bought? Engineered? You tell me the difference. Maybe it meant the lobby installed pop-up or ejection seats before Netanyahu's arrival. Well, one related and vitally critical subject that almost no one in Washington mentions, and definitely not President Obama, who's afraid to acknowledge their existence, nor the Israeli occupying Congress, whose members know what they can and cannot get away with, is Israel's stock of nuclear weapons and the role played by Israel's friends in the U.S. in developing those weapons. There are exceptions in the nation's capital, people who speak the truth, and on this, the last program of my 10th year on the KZYX airwaves, we're going to speak again with the most important of them, Grant Smith of IRMEP, the Institute for Research in Middle East Policy, and the Israel Lobby Archive. Unless you've been tuned to Takes on the World, you've probably never heard of him, since the subject he covers are not only too hot for NPR, they're also apparently too hot for Democracy Now! Since 2002, Smith has used Freedom of Information Act to obtain heretofore ignored or newly declassified U.S. government documents to produce a number of books and a website, Israeli Lobby Archive, that illustrates what might be most accurately described as a low-intensity war by Israel against the people of the United States. His latest book, which will be published next month, is Divert, Numek, Zalman Shapiro, and the Diversion of U.S. Weapons-Grade Uranium into the Israeli Nuclear Program. That's what we'll be talking about when I get him on the phone about 20 minutes past the hour. Meanwhile, let's look at some other important news related and unrelated. This is related. As if $3 billion a year in military aid paid in cash isn't enough, last Friday, President Obama signed a bill that includes a provision to expand U.S. military assistance to Israel by another $236 million. Pentagon reportedly had proposed an addition of $100 million, but Congress upped the total by another $136 million. Israel will use the money in fiscal 212 for the development of three missile defense programs. Imagine what that $236 million plus the $3 billion already committed to Israel could do for our economy. But when it comes to Israel, Congress gives Americans a short end of the stick. One of those members, Congressman Steve Rothman, a Democrat from cash-starved New Jersey, is a committed Israel firster. That's why he was appointed to the House Appropriations Defense Committee in the first place. Rothman praised Obama's decision to sign into the law what he called, quote, the highest levels of funding for the joint U.S.-Israel missile defense programs in our history, end quote. It's more than likely the voters of New Jersey will never hear about that, nor for that matter will the voters of California and all the states in between. There's been a great deal in the media about Israel exchanging hundreds of Palestinian prisoners held illegally in Israeli prisons for the return of one Israeli corporal, Gilad Shalit, who was captured at the Gaza border while on active duty in June of 2006. What you haven't heard is that as of December 12th, Israel's occupying forces had arrested nearly 470 Palestinians since October 18th. That was the day when 477 Palestinian political prisoners were released in exchange for Galit as part of the first phase of a prisoner exchange deal concluded between Israel and Hamas. Israel is apparently attempting to placate its internal critics of the deal by replacing the freed prisoners with as many new ones as possible. Even the released prisoners have not been safe from harassment, as the Israeli military has regularly raided their homes, issued summons to meet with Israeli intelligence, and rearrested one individual. Among the 470 arrested between October 18th and December 12th, about 70 children were 70 children, 11 women. Israel continues to employ undercover operatives, commonly known as Musta'arevim, who dress as Palestinian civilians in order to carry out ambushes and arrest the Palestinians at their home and workplaces. In many cases, the raids occurred after midnight when soldiers deliberately destroyed contents of the houses they were searching, a phenomenon I witnessed myself when I was staying in Dehesha camp in Bethlehem in 2004. Out of the 70 children arrested during the period, the majority are from Shufat camp in Jerusalem and from Dehesha. Meanwhile, Israel continues to announce the building of 1,000 new housing units in the occupied West Bank and Jerusalem, which the Obama administration continues to announce as, quote, unhelpful, end quote, while blocking UN attempts to censure it. While failing to put any pressure on Israel to resume negotiations with the Palestinians. This became too much for the UN Security Council when, as reported by the Associated Press on December 20th, quote, 14 frustrated members of the UN Security Council pointed a finger at the United States for blocking any condemnation of Israel's accelerated settlement construction in Palestinian territory. In a move which Russia's UN ambassador Vitaly Churkin called historic, diplomats from almost all regional blocs represented on the council stepped to the microphone after closed council consultations on the Mideast to condemn the lack of progress toward a solution of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Churkin, the current council president, said the frustration over the impasse in Israeli-Palestinian talks spilled out in statements from the four European Council members, the Non-Aligned Movement, the Arab Group, and the Group of Emerging Powers that includes India, Brazil, and South Africa. Clearly referring to the United States, Churkin said dismissively, the one delegation believes things will miraculously sort themselves out on their own. The call for bilateral negotiations without preconditions would seem a normal thing to ask for, he said. But Churkin said the Palestinians are overwhelmed militarily and in every other way by the Israelis, and without preconditions they would not get a fair shake in negotiations, end quote. Israel responded the next day, firing off a sharp and rather undiplomatic riposte to four European countries, France, Britain, Germany, and Portugal, that forcefully condemned Israel's building plans, according to the Jerusalem Post, and as saying the Europeans were risking losing credibility and relevance with the reflexive condemnations of construction beyond the Green Line. War Secretary Leon Panetta, after being chastised by the pro-Israel lobby and punditocracy for criticizing Israel's lack of interest in negotiations with the Palestinians, attempted to get back in the good graces in an interview with CBS, responding when asked how the U.S. would deal with an Israeli attack on Iran, quote, well, we share the common concern, he said. The United States does not want Iran to develop a nuclear weapon. That's a red line for us, and that's a red line, obviously, for the Israelis. If we have to do it, we will deal with it. If they proceed and we get intelligence that they are proceeding with developing a nuclear weapon, then we will take whatever step necessary to stop it. Including military steps, he was asked. There are no options off the table, Panetta responded. More Iraq Redux. The State Department has authorized a reward of up to $10 million for information leading to the location of Ezzedine Abdel Aziz Khalil, better known as Yasin al-Suri, who, it claims, is a senior al-Qaeda facilitator and financier based in Iran, for which it provides no evidence and which Iran denies. The State Department press release states as fact that, quote, operating under an agreement between al-Qaeda and the Iranian government, al-Suri moves money and al-Qaeda recruits in the Middle East through Iran and on to Pakistan and Afghanistan, end quote. And that, quote, Iranian authorities maintain a relationship with al-Suri and have permitted him to operate within Iran's borders since 2005, end quote. This is typical of the same kind of propaganda that was being issued by the Bush administration in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. And then we have John Yoo, the U.S. professor who provided the legal basis for U.S. troops torturing prisoners in Afghanistan and Iraq, and who paid no price either in the courts or academically. In the current issue of National Review, he writes, quote, the United States has assumed the role, once held by Great Britain, of guaranteeing free trade and economic development, spreading liberal values, and maintaining international security. An attack on Iranian nuclear facilities, writes Hu, though it would impose costs in human lives and political turmoil, would serve these interests and forestall the spread of conflict and terror. The Republican presidential candidates, writes Yu, should begin preparing the case now for this difficult but unavoidable challenge, end quote. And yet there appears to be no sign of any widespread public opposition to what would be an act of insanity on the part of Washington. Whom the gods would destroy, they must first make mad, wrote Euripides about 450 B.C., and stupid, I would add. Want more evidence? In what seems to be a replay of Jimmy Carter's unwise decision to allow the Shah of Iran to receive medical treatment in the U.S. in 1979, which led to the takeover of the U.S. embassy in Tehran and the hostage crisis, which led to Carter's defeat, President Obama has reportedly decided to allow Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh to enter the United States to receive, quote, legitimate medical treatment, end quote, for injuries suffered in an attack on his headquarters earlier this year. The announcement came just hours after Yemeni government forces killed 9 people who were participating in a rally demanding that Saleh be tried for deaths of hundreds of protesters over the past year. Saleh agreed last month to step down in return for immunity from prosecution for himself and his family, a decision that has not been well received by the opposition in the streets. Given that throughout the Yemeni uprising, Washington has been reserved in its criticism of the Saleh government, while continuing to conduct airstrikes against what it claims to be al-Qaeda targets in the south of the country, Obama's decision is likely to prove as unwise as was President Carter's in 1979. Finally, on my last program, I gave you an update on the push by Walmart to expand its present store in the Airport Boulevard shopping complex by 52,000 feet and become a 24/7 full-service grocery and the local efforts to prevent it. That was December 14th, and that night the Ukiah Planning Commission was scheduled to decide on the issue. Thanks to the project's proponents, it didn't happen, and the fight goes on. The next and probably last meeting of the Planning Commission regarding the project will be January 11th, where they will be voting on the site development permit. Given that its acceptance of the final EIR as quote-unquote adequate on December 14th was less than enthusiastic, it's difficult to predict which way the commission will vote. In order to approve it in the face of what even the project's proponents acknowledge will be increased traffic at the 101 Talmadge Airport Boulevard interchange with no money in the pipeline to mitigate it, the commission would have to approve a statement of overriding considerations. This would, in effect, amount to them saying to the people of Ukiah that the benefits of having Walmart open a 6th or 7th supermarket in Ukiah, depending on how one counts, outweighs the potential life-threatening dangers of a greatly increased traffic flow that will extend traffic jams into 101 that will also consequently have a negative effect on all the other businesses in the airport shopping complex. Should it be approved, under those circumstances, the city would be facing the likelihood of major lawsuits occurring in the wake of any fatal or injurious accidents caused by the increased traffic on 101. In any case, however the Planning Commission votes, one can count on the losing side appealing to the City Council, which will then make the final decision. Again, The next meeting of the Planning Commission is on January 11th at City Hall, 300 Seminary Drive, and it will begin at 6 p.m., no doubt before a packed house. And with standing room only, as was the case at the last two commission meetings on this subject.